Part 3. Chapter 8. Errantry. Bontali Riverlands. Summer. Tyndall. After the boys returned to Sevendore from Raylancourt early that summer, their wounds mostly healed, there was a tangible change in their relationship. Far from contesting territory around the castle with innumerable petty fights, they stayed far away from each other when they could. That wasn't too hard. Though the spring ploughing season was over and vegetable planting was underway, there was still plenty of military work for them to do. And with Lady Alia's belly growing ever greater with the spellmonger's new baby, the mysterious machinations of the Alka Alon in their new tower of Leiskathal, Karshak work crews seemed to be everywhere, and the approaching autumn magic fair, Master Minilan did not have much time to spare for them, and he had an abundant list for them. Rondal worked with the militia groups at Brestall Tower, using his newfound knowledge to drill the rudiments of infantry into the heads of Bovali and Brestalli lads. Tyndall was on duty at the expanding Dyke Tower complex, seeding the place with fresh enchantments, while he watched Master Olmeg and his company of riverfolk plant yet more trees in Sevendor's outer enchanted forest. At night, they bunked in different parts of the domain. Even when both boys were at Sevendor Castle, they avoided each other. Tyndall was still wary of how furious Rondal had been their last few days at Raylancourt, and while their mutual injuries were healed, their feelings were apparently not. There was something still bothering Rondal, Tyndall knew, something that kept the boy glaring at him whenever they saw each other. So Tyndall just avoided the glare. He found a way to be elsewhere. It wasn't like he didn't have plenty to distract him other than trees. The girls from Bovol Hall, across the road from the Dyke Tower, where he claimed a bed, never failed to stop by and chat with him, flirting outrageously as he improved the arcane defences of the place. He did not try to deter them, despite the fact that some of their fathers would not let his knighthood, or his youth, keep them from beating him to within an inch of his life. Tyndall just liked girls, and liked their attention. Pretty ones, ugly ones, dumb ones, smart ones, he liked girls. And he liked how they scrambled over themselves to try to impress him. It was amusing, most days. He was being amused by two of the young ladies from Bovol Hall who were supposed to be planting cabbages when he was called up to the castle with a mind-to-mind summons from his master. He sadly bid the girls farewell, turned over his duties to the ancient on duty, saddled up a nag and rode up to Sevendor Castle. Just as he was leaving the Dyke Tower, Rondal rode up next to him, late from Brestall Tower. "So, he summoned you too, eh?" Rondal grunted. "Must be important." "Apparently," Tyndall grunted back. "I won't complain of a change of duty." "Yes, enduring adoring girls and watching trees grow is so arduous," Rondal said dryly. "True, but I wouldn't mind stretching my legs a bit. I felt for certain that Master Min would have deployed us by now. Things are bad in North Gilmora, I hear." "Maybe that's what's happening now," Rondal pointed out. "Might be," Tyndall considered. "Only one way to find out." The castle doors were thrown open to let the cool spring breezes air it out. Even so, a fire burned on the hearth. The days were warming, but the white snowstone castle seemed to take a long time to realize it. Master Minilan and Sire Kay were waiting for them in the great hall. At the big stone table, Sire Kay once broke with his fist, and Rondal had to meld back together. Tyndall was instantly anxious. He admired Sire Kay, but he always had the feeling that the older knight was looking to catch him in something. Probably just residual guilty conscience from his youth in Bovol, he reasoned, but that did not curb his anxiety. "Well, gentlemen," Master Minilan said, his big green sphere bobbing merrily over his shoulder like a faithful hawk. "You have learned magic and you have learned warfare, but you have yet to learn how to be knights." Both of them groaned. "Is there some diabolical camp where they beat such things into you?" moaned Rondal. "If I read another scroll, Master," Tyndall assured him, "my head may well explode." "Nonsense, both of you," Minilan said cheerfully. "You now have the skills of a war mage, the abilities of a soldier, but to be a knight, that is beyond the scope of either scroll or drill instructor. For that, you need instruction in chivalry."
"So who's going to teach us?"
Tyndall asked, fearful of the answer.
"I am," Sire Kay said firmly. I was squired for 9 years before I won my spurs, he said proudly. Squired to one of the most honourable knights in all of Alshar, a Wilderlord of renown. He inspired in me a love of chivalry that speeds my every action, and I feel compelled to extend those valuable lessons to the two of you.
Sire Kay is teaching us chivalry,
Rondel asked suspiciously. There is no one better, Master Menelan said, a challenge to name one, implicit in his answer. He is regarded among the local knights as a most well-trained gentleman, for all his foreign ways. He's highly admired for his devotion to the vocation and his knowledge of its good and proper practice. Therefore, I am turning your education over to him for a few weeks this summer, so that he might pour the finer points of chivalry into your brains. With a hammer, if need be, Menelan added, with good-natured menace.
But do we have to learn to joust? Rondel asked anxiously.
I'd hate that.
I'd love that,
Tyndall said, thrilled at the idea. He could fight from horseback, he knew, but the manipulation of horse, knight, shield and lance on the field of battle was a highly specialized skill, one that drew honor, glory and acclaim.
There is more to being a knight than tilting, Sire Kay affirmed, without humor. More than tilting, swordplay, horsemanship and all of the other traditional duties of the knight. Any man-at-arms can master those. No, gentlemen, to be a true knight, to honor and value the codes of chivalry, is to transform the warrior into the nobleman, the soldier into the statesman. Within the institution of knighthood, he pronounced, lies the very best aspirations of mortal men and the gods' desires alike.
As if we didn't have enough to live up to,
Rondel sighed, rolling his eyes.
Master, is this really necessary?
Tyndall asked, shaking his head.
It feels as if we spent a year in training.
Not even close. Although I'd welcome the chance to have given you a full year, Master Menelan said, eyeing them both thoughtfully. You have both done well at what I have tasked you with, apart from a little friction, but fighting and magic are not the totality of how you are to be of use to me. You are two of the first Knights Magi. Others will be looking to you for guidance. It would be helpful to me if you had some inkling of what was expected of you in terms of chivalry.
So we're just going to stay here and train?
Tyndall asked miserably.
I thought for sure we'd be deployed to Gilmora.
Gilmora doesn't need you yet, Menelan said, shaking his head. Things are bad there, but they're static. The goblins have not tried to advance beyond where they were last year. Unfortunately, that means that they're picking the region clean. Every human they capture goes north, up the Timber Road and into the Penumbra. They don't come back. But they aren't moving forward, either, continued the spellmonger. That gives us time to build strength, prepare a defense, and determine what their goals are. None of which requires the two of you. So, for the next few weeks, until midsummer at least, you will be in Sire Kay's charge. But you won't be staying here, he added. My newest apprentice finds you distracting. No, don't worry, I'll deal with her. But for now, it would be more convenient if you were away from Sevendor Castle while you learned knighthood.
So where?
My estate, Sire Kay said dreamily. Car Gwenyon. We leave in the morning.
They made the peaceful journey back to the tiny estate Sire Kay had won at last year's tournament at the Chepstone Spring Fair on horseback, three gentlemen riding. They spent the time discussing chivalry in general, the older knight using the opportunity to lecture them about the noble codes of ethics and warfare that were the basis of the military class. Once they were at Car Gwenyon, however, his manner changed from lecturer to administrator. Tyndall was impressed with the man's versatility, one of the qualities of the well-trained knight, Sire Kay insisted. The Wilderlord seemed to fit in the small Riverlands estate perfectly. Tyndall reflected that he seemed as natural in the role of a country knight of a small estate as he was the castellan of a busy castle. First, he greeted his pregnant wife, Lady Estret, whom he had also won in the tournament, in the yard of the small manor with a gentle grace and obvious affection that was so vulnerable that it made Tyndall blush to watch. He inquired after her health and the state of her pregnancy, listening to every detail with uncommon eagerness. Then he greeted his stepdaughter, little 8-year-old Lady Farisa, and her puppies, before sparing any attention to business.
Then the knight tended to his estate's affairs immediately afterward, however, quickly consulting with his steward about important matters of business with the alacrity of a merchant, and delivering instruction about village affairs with the confidence of a captain, before returning his attention to his two young charges. He had done all of it without seeming overwhelmed by the varied nature of his duties or the import of his decisions. Indeed, he made that very matter the subject of one of their first official lessons in chivalry. "The role of a knight in our society is manifold," Sire Kay explained to them after luncheon in the manor's great hall, no larger than a small tavern. "With him lies the responsibility to defend and protect the people, to act with authority of ordering their affairs, to defend the weak against the oppressive, yet to enforce the lawful orders of our liege and his administration. Any man can be knighted, at cause, but to be a knight is a commitment to that manifold responsibility. At once a warrior and a landowner, an administrator and leader of men, devoted to an ideal but committed to a society replete with custom, knighthood requires a tremendous amount of responsibility to do well, and much training and observation of good chivalric examples, which the two of you unfortunately lack. We have you and Sire Cousy," Tyndall reminded him. "We're quick studies," Rondell assured him. "There are some things that cannot be learned from a book," Sir Tyndall, the older knight said, pouring wine for each of them. 10,000 rules of social behaviour and responsibility, mostly unwritten, which you are required by your new station to know and enforce. Usually a squire picks them up in service to a knight over the course of years. The mage lord has invested me with the responsibility of shortening that period for you, considerably."
"And just what does that entail?" asked Rondell, suspiciously.
"Whatever I decide it entails," Sire Kay replied dryly. "Everything a knight does, and how he does it, has meaning and purpose. For instance, the fact that I am serving you wine has meaning."
"It means I need a drink," Tyndall agreed. "It means that this is a serious discussion," Rondell guessed.
"More," Sire Kay explained as he swirled the wine around in the opaque glass goblet. "Wine is a luxury which requires a sophisticated and well-run estate to cultivate, produce, ship, and sell it. It only grows better with age, and the older the vintage, the higher the quality. A suitable symbol for a hereditary class. A stable, prosperous hereditary class whose holdings span generations. Ale, mead, and spirits have different meanings," he explained, gesturing with his goblet. "But when a senior gentleman pours wine for two juniors in rank, it indicates that he is giving them instruction or orders, and that a special note should be taken."
"That's what wine means?" Tyndall frowned.
"That seemed complicated for a mere beverage. Not just the wine in context of the situation. If I was your peer instead of senior, then the nature and tone of the discussion would change. This is the way our society has determined a senior noble instruct junior nobles. If there were oaths of fealty involved, then the context changes, and so does the meaning of the service."
"But why?"
Tyndall asked, confused.
"Why should wine signify, well, anything?"
"Something must," Sire Kay explained. "Such social cues enrich our conversation, as they are invested in meaning. The meaning supplies the context for us without the need for further explanation. Our agreement on the meaning of wine in this context marks us as fellow members in our culture of understanding, and wine is a pleasant enough drink for the meaning. If we are having ale, however, then the context changes. Our social ranks are removed with ale, not emphasized. As it is more common and less expensive, so does the context of our conversation change to subjects of a less formal nature. It would not be proper to discuss weighty matters over ale," he lectured. "A couple of comrades from the wars, however, can reminisce about old campaigns over ales. We can talk about our wives, our children, our homes, but rarely about our definite plans, money, or property. Nor would I give you serious instruction or command over ale. These customs are understood among all men of the duchies, from duke to cowherd. We share a common understanding of their meanings."
"How about mead?" Tyndall asked with a grin. "Or spirits?"
"Mead is for celebrations, thank goodness," Sire Kay said, looking up toward the honeycomb heraldry he had won with his tiny fief.
As the owner and patron of an apiary, a great deal of his revenue came from those who brewed mead, Tyndall knew. He also knew that, soon after taking possession of both land and wife, Sayake had invested greatly in building a meadery on his fief in fulfilment of his charter. A bride and groom are supposed to take 7 bottles on their honeymoon, and not return until they are all but 1 empty, if the union is to be fruitful. A man toasts his love with mead, or a dear friend, an intimate friend. He drinks to the health of a babe or a marriage. To a maid it implies friendly seduction, or at least flirtation. In death, mead signifies mourning and sorrow. A girl's first bleeding or a boy's entrance into a trade or profession is celebrated with mead and hydromel. Blessing a new home is also appropriate for mead.
And spirits? Asked Rondell, curious.
Business, mostly, Sire Kay said. He knew the knight was not partial to spirits himself. And some men do not hesitate to use the courage from the flask to make bold propositions.
And foolish ones, the knight reminded. Domains have been lost due to a man being too overcome with spirits and making a rash decision over his life.
And in battle, a sip of spirits in the company of gentlemen is considered fortifying, a sign of mutual respect, or a way to raise morale, particularly if a senior-ranked officer does so with his juniors.
"I remember some at Timberwatch who respected each other a lot,"
snorted Tyndall. "In some cases spirits can drive away the pain and grief of war," admitted Sire Kay, sadly. "My own father sought such refuge and paid the price. But we were discussing the customs of wine."
"What about tea?" Rondell asked.
Tyndall looked disgusted.
"Tea? Who the hells cares about tea?
Your brother knight makes a point," Sire Kay agreed. "Offering tea is a sign of hospitality and warmth, accepting it a sign of friendship. That is true in peasant's hut or king's castle, and offering milk to a grown man would be an insult, lest he requested it. It would be appropriate to a maid of sufficient youth."
"This is confusing," Tyndall said. "No, it's not," Rondell grumbled.
"It's not just what is being shared, but by whom, and where and when. The drink is secondary to the meaning," he ventured.
"Of course, it's all so clear to me now,"
Tyndall said sarcastically.
"Exactly, Sir Rondell,"
Sire Kay approved. "They are all part of a knight's understanding of the world."
"So drinking wine in the afternoon would be a different meaning than drinking wine at night?"
"Yes. The context changes, depending upon whether food is involved and what kind. On feast days, wine is celebratory, a compliment to the food. On ordinary days, drinking wine is a way to honour a guest. And while either wine or mead can be drunk as the stirrup cup in parting, wine signifies a more formal character, while mead a more personal. The rules change if the drink is between a man and a woman, too, and their relationships, of course, must be taken into account. If a member of the clergy is present, the rules change again, as does the context. Discussing gentleman's humour in the presence of a priestess of Trigg while drinking wine would be improper, especially before sundown. Drinking spirits with the same birth sister at midnight, however, would be an appropriate time to share such jests, and hear a few in return."
"So why must a knight know all of this?" Rondell asked.
"It is part of his station. Not because he drinks wine when he is supposed to, but because he does so and understands why. Hospitality is a noble virtue that all knights should exhibit, whether to his liege or lord, to his vassals and yeomen, or to his brother knights. Knowing those ciphers helps smooth relations between gentlemen and allows much of import to go unsaid."
"It seems to be no more than a method for someone to find offence," Rondell said suspiciously.
"Such things have happened," admitted Kay. "A wise man, and wisdom is another chivalric virtue, knows how to avoid such things by applying yet other social rules. Also context-dependent. A good knight will be adept at avoiding them in the first place, but if circumstance and fortune place him in such a position, he will do what needs to be done. Remember, a knight is a warrior, first and foremost."
"A warrior with wine," Tyndall snickered.
"There are many kinds of battles, and wine is but another arrow in your quiver. What a man might gain by the sword, he may well lose by the cup, if he is incautious.
About gaining by the sword, Tyndall began slowly. Just what are a knight's duties, responsibilities, and liabilities in conquering someone? Sire Kay smirked.
Ambitiously planning your empire, are you?
Well, is that not the right of any knight? Asked Rondell. The right to challenge possession in combat?
Ambition is good in a young knight, but without support from a good liege, going around and randomly attacking someone else's property is rarely a wise idea. Such errantry exists, as some lords feel that if a man can conquer, he is strong enough to hold it, and will be, therefore, a better vassal than his predecessor. Other times they take great offence, often with hundreds of men-at-arms. If you plan on conquering a domain, Sir Tyndall, you had best be prepared to fight to keep it. If your neighbours do not attack you, your predecessor nearly always has relatives. And even if you should prevail, you may well find your new lands very difficult to rule.
Like the troubles Master Minolan is having, Rondell observed.
In that context, it is Mage Lord Minolan, reminded Sire Kay. He holds those lands and rules them on the basis of his nobility, not his profession.
I see, Tyndall frowned. But if I wanted to raise an army and take them away from him, theoretically, then I prophesize that Mage Lord Minolan would kick your ass until your nose bled, theoretically speaking, pronounced Rondell.
Raising an army is not as easy as it sounds. Many a knight has beggared himself hiring men for conquest, and afterward ended up a sellsword himself to pay off the debt. Raising an army of peasants is possible, of course, but doing so is rarely seen in a favourable light by your peers.
Peasant uprisings, nodded Rondell sagely.
Dead peasants, corrected Sire Kay. A man who falls to a sword cannot plough a field or clip a sheep. A knight who is not capable of conquering a domain by attracting real fighting men to his cause is rarely worthy of such rule, history shows. Oft the best conquerors make the poorest rulers. Such men are better suited to selling their swords in service of more powerful men, rather than inflict their poor rule on some poor peasantry. And, of course, there is the legality. If a proper writ of conquest is not submitted to the kingdom, then the king can order you deposed and the original owner, or his heirs, restored. If you wish to contend with a royal army, the likes of the one Count Salgo is building, I wish you luck, and I pray we meet again in the afterlife.
I see, Tyndall said, scratching his chin.
I hope you do, Sire Kay said sternly. Such conquests should never be entered into lightly, for the cost of war is dear to all. A knight should be prepared for battle always, but never lust for it so much that he destroys more than he gains. His honour, most of all.
And a domain that can be easily conquered is likely not worth the price, Rondell observed. No offence, Sire Kay, but should someone wish to conquer it, then they will face the wrath of my liege, and kin to my lady wife.
Sire Kay grinned. As his son holds one of my neighbouring domains, and his son-in-law another, I feel secure enough not to invest in fortifying my tiny fief. Besides, he chuckled, whomever would risk such retribution would win a poor prize. It may be a lovely place, but it is hardly lucrative. Bees make poor tenants.
But not all knights are landholders, Rondell pointed out. You weren't, until you won the Chepstow Fair tournament.
True, Sir Rondell, agreed Sire Kay. The difference between sir and sire. There are many landless knights, oft younger sons of poorer houses, who have the training and skills to rule a domain in theory, but lack the patrimony to do so. Usually they take honourable service with a higher ranked lord, for as you know, there is much involved with the management of estates. I served as deputy castellan for Lord Mayor in Gans, before Sire Cousy took me to service under old Sir Gindon. When the old knight took ill, Sire Cousy gave me the opportunity, and then found little reason to change.
What happens if you can't find a lord to serve? Asked Tyndall, looking amused for some reason.
Then one has three honourable recourses, Sire Kay said, refilling the glasses for a second time. To take service with one of the free companies, to take holy orders, or errantry.
Errantry, Rondell repeated. Doesn't that just mean
It means a number of things to a number of people, explained the knight with a smile. Usually it means wandering from place to place, looking for a position. But horses must eat, and knights cannot graze by the side of the road. So a knight-errant will fast, pray, and seek what opportunity the gods see fit to send to him. At need, a knight might work for wages, but only when starvation beckons. When no honourable means is available to sustain him, then traditionally the knight seeks to live on his honour, finding a cause to support, a widow to defend, a tournament to enter, a shrine to protect, a rogue to be slain, or a fair lady to be rescued from a horrible marriage, grinned Tyndall. Those are far fewer than the stories would suggest, chuckled Kay. But I cannot say such things do not happen. Not after how I met my good Estet, he said, glancing out the window fondly at his pregnant beloved, who was tending the flower garden with her daughter and a crone from the village. Errantry can prove its own reward, and every knight should undertake it at some point in his career. That seems like a haphazard way to pursue one's livelihood, Rondell said doubtfully. I prefer a roof over my head and a good meal every now and again. A knight must have faith that the gods will reward his honour and support his chivalry through their providence, Sire Kay pointed out. If a knight did not throw his fate into the wind without fear from time to time, then the gods have little opportunity to blow the chaff of his life to the wind, leaving only the kernel of his honour. That's a complicated metaphor, Tyndall said slowly, struggling to understand the meaning. But apt, I promise you, Sire Kay assured with confidence. Choose another, if you like. Consider steel. It must be tested and tried by fire and hammer, heated red hot, beaten and beaten. Wheat is a fine metaphor, Rondell interrupted, for Huin is a mighty god and Trigg, his wife, is the mother of all. Every knight should have the faith in his skills and the blessings of the gods in his life to test himself. In tournaments against his worthy peers, in battle against a fell enemy, in the world against injustice and disorder. In so doing, he not only seeks to improve himself and his fortunes, but test his peers and give them good challenge of their own honour and chivalry. And enrich himself, should the chance occur? Tyndall added cagily. Strong faith is oft well rewarded by fortune, conceded Sire Kay unapologetically. But when the fickle hand of Ifnia is involved, such faith can lead to glorious death or utter ignominy as easily as fortune and glory. Such are the caprices of the goddess of luck. But by fortune's fires, our faith and virtue into our honour is forged, the chaff blown away by challenge. Only by attempting the difficult, or rising to the harder challenge, can we exceed the frontiers we ourselves set for ourselves. Ever does the knight seek to improve himself, for honour is a cup never filled. Which brings me to my final point about wine, Sire Kay said, draining his glass. One cup for courtesy, two for orders, three for instruction, but no more in one sitting if you want to get anything else done in the day. And while quiet reflection feeds a man's soul, we have much work to be done and precious little time to do it. Tomorrow, gentlemen, we embark on your abbreviated squirehood. Warriors and magi you might be, but tomorrow you learn the sublime art of chivalry. The next morning saw them in a familiar situation, if an unfamiliar place. The practice yard of Carguenyon was just off the main yard, a well-tended sandpit that had seen decades of moderate use. It was more garden than guard's den, with planters of flowers and herbs around the edges, and a wide paved stone pergola at one end. Spring's bounty had caused hundreds of blooms to decorate the place, a living, multicoloured tapestry of flowers surrounding them, and providing nectar for the bees the estate relied upon. "This is lovely," he declared, chuckling as he strapped on his armour. "I feel so dainty." It certainly smelled better than any practice yard he'd fought in, Tyndall decided. It was a decided change from both the practical mud pit at Sevendor Castle and the gloomy, expansive facilities of Raylancourt. It was far more pleasant in form than the little sandyard at Inarion that had played such a significant role in his recent history. You'll feel less so if one of Noarpa's children chances to join you under your gambeson, Sayake chuckled as he strapped his thick leather gorget around his neck. It sounded as if he knew from experience. As pretty as it is, it suits our purposes. I want to see how you two rogues have improved your swordplay since last we crossed swords.
I think we might surprise you, Tyndall smirked, eager for the challenge.
He had trained hard at Raylancourt, spending hours and hours in the yards and learning all he could from whomever he could get to teach him. He felt his skills had vastly improved, and were well able to prevail over such a mature man as Sire Kay.
I hope you do, Sire Kay said, settling his battered helm on his head. You and I first, Sir Tyndall.
Tyndall had been anticipating this contest for weeks. Apart from their master, they both had sparred with the Castellan as their instructor for most of the last year. It had been his yelling, sarcastic insults, and discipline to which they had been subjected, and he was as close a thing to a swordplay master as Tyndall had. They saluted solemnly, the gods, the ancestors, and each other, and began. Both were using single practice swords. Tyndall had the wooden double of slasher he used for practice, less blade and more hilt than the traditional greatsword Sire Kay's weapon mimicked. It was lighter, and presumably more manoeuvrable.
No augmentation spells, Rondell called from the side. That would be cheating.
I know,
Tyndall said, annoyed. It was just like Rondell, trying to bring him down before a bout. He was trying to enjoy this. They circled and sized each other up as if they were meeting him for the first time. Tyndall saw a large warrior with a very big sword, but he also noted how close together Sire Kay's footwork was. He had learned that such steps usually signalled an overly cautious nature, and a willingness to only attack when the advantage was clear. Tyndall, on the other hand, took much wider steps. He crossed a lot of ground compared to Kay, and soon he was circling the Dragon Slayer instead of the movement being mutual. That suited him fine. He took two quick steps and threw a strike at Sire Kay's right shoulder, only to have it blocked when the man twisted and parried. That surprised Tyndall. He thought the move would have gotten past Sire Kay's guard. Tyndall threw a fast combination from the sword dance, but the knight managed to deflect all of his strikes without so much as twitching his moustache. He switched to a leg and shoulder targeting flurry of blows that departed wildly from what he was used to, only to have Sire Kay sidestep the first one, block the second, and catch the third on the tip of his blade, before powering back so hard that Tyndall nearly lost his footing. That was frustrating, he realized, as his boots skidded him to a halt in the sand. Tyndall had fully expected to have first blood by now. He shook off his disappointment and launched a sophisticated combination that involved half steps in one direction and then a change-up to the other, then a sudden dart back. Ordinarily, he should have bisected his opponent. Sire Kay was too fast. When his fake mage blade swept back, Kay's long blade was inexplicably in the way, held at an angle behind him, over his shoulder. Tyndall was so surprised he didn't realize that he had been set up for a nasty spin attack that drove the sweet spot of the blade so hard against his helm that his ears rung.
First blood,
Rondell called. He sounded pleased with it.
All right, Tyndall sighed. What did I do wrong?
Nothing, Sire Kay said, taking a step back and raising his helmet. You did it flawlessly.
Then how come you got first blood? Complained Tyndall.
Because while you performed flawlessly, that doesn't always mean you prevail. There is a lesson there.
Again!
Sire Kay and Tyndall sparred for 5 or 6 bouts, before Tyndall finally scored a solid hit on the man. He became more and more impressed by Kay, and realized just how much he had babied them before they had gone to the war college. At first he resented it, and then he just felt a little embarrassed. But he started trying a little harder, and just when he was starting to get exasperated, he finally saw an opening and struck.
Well done, Kay said approvingly. You really have improved, Sir Tyndall. I can see a definite refinement in your technique. You have true talent at this. Now, you, he said, pointing at Rondell, barely breathing heavy.
Rondell nodded grimly and pulled the practice helmet over his face. Rondell's practice blade was slightly shorter, and he had a tendency to use it one-handed more than Tyndall did. Tyndall expected Sire Kay to make short work of him. To Tyndall's surprise, Rundle took a defensive position and waited for Kay to engage. As a result, he was able to block two blows from the greatsword before pushing back, dropping his two-handed grip to use his arm to counterbalance. Not as hard as he could, but enough to push Kay slightly out of line. His wooden blade tapped the older knight lightly on his unprotected forehead.
"Strike," Kay said,
surprised and impressed.
"First blood. Well done, Sir Rundle."
Tyndall's mouth was open. He had laid into Kay with as serious an attack as he was able to muster without magic, and the man had defended nearly everyone. Then this bookworm gets in the ring and scores a point in moments. Despite his effort to control himself, he sucked in air through his teeth. Rundle spent 10 minutes showing off the skills he'd developed at Raylancourt, and while he lacked the sophistication of Tyndall or Sire Kay, even Tyndall had to admit that his footwork was solid, his positioning was well-formed, and his strikes were clear and hard. They took a water break and discussed their performance before Sire Kay instructed them both to attack him at the same time.
Sire Kay, do you really think that's fair? Tyndall asked skeptically.
Probably not, the knight conceded, but I'll take it easy on you.
He lowered his visor. Tyndall looked at Rundle, who shrugged. Tyndall sighed and pulled his own helm back on. Rundle was on his left, so Tyndall moved quickly to Kay's right side. He threw a quick blow at his thighs, which Kay sidestepped without deigning to watch, and then pivoted and threw another blow across his shoulders. To his dismay, his blade got entangled with Rundle's, enough so that he heard the dull thunk of wood on steel a moment before he heard it much louder, and much more painfully. When the ringing in his ears stopped, he heard Kay chuckling wickedly.
"That, gentlemen, is what happens when you don't work together. Again!"
They continued trying to defeat Kay for another 20 minutes, stopping here and there to discuss the fighting. In the last bout of the day, they both tried much harder, but to no avail. The faster and harder they attacked, the faster Sire Kay seemed to defend, although Tyndall was gratified to see the older knight start to get rushed. Just when he thought they had worn the man down and could start beating on his helmet like a drum, Kay grunted, twisted, and sent his sword singing across Tyndall's chest. Too late, they all realized that there was magic involved. As the blade hit Tyndall's armor, Kay's talent unexpectedly engaged. The wooden sword shattered. Tyndall was thrown back 20 feet across the yard to land on his back, looking up at the treetops.
"Ow!"
he groaned, his chest throbbing.
"Is she's tits?" Rundle said. "Are you dead?"
"Sir Tyndall,"
Kay said, throwing his helmet off and rushing to the boy's side anxiously.
"Pray the gods you are all right."
"How?"
Tyndall reprised. He felt like he had been kicked by a charger, with both hooves.
"I don't think I broke anything."
He pulled himself slowly to a seated position with their help.
"Doings X, Sir Kay. I hope I didn't get you riled."
"Apparently you did," Rundle said thoughtfully. "It looks like his wild talent activated. Magical force transformed to concussive force at the point of impact. There are similar effects from spells in the libraries at Raylancourt. They take a lot of power," he added.
"I remember,"
Tyndall said, rubbing his chest where the wooden sword had struck.
"I read them too. I just never thought I'd be on the other end of one."
"My apologies, Sir Tyndall,"
Sire Kay said, helping him to his feet.
"I cannot always control this talent. Perhaps it would be best if we called the end of practice."
"I would hesitate to argue with that," Rundle agreed. "Does that happen often, Sire Kay?"
"Only when I get roused," he admitted. "If I hold my temper and control myself, I can keep it from happening."
He sounded anxious about it.
"Of all the gifts you could have gotten from the gods, there are many far worse,"
Tyndall pointed out, still gasping for air.
"For a knight to be able to deliver such a blow in battle,
yes,"
Sire Kay said, helping Tyndall strip off his armor.
"But on the practice field, well, I would hesitate to send home only half of the apprentices the Mage Lord entrusted to me. It wouldn't reflect well."
That afternoon they studied the lineages of the great houses, particularly the ducal houses and powerful counts and other dynasties. Tyndall was in the middle of reciting perfectly all of the dukes of Rhymia in order when he got the tingle of sensation that indicated a request for mind-to-mind communication.
"Tyndall, how is your tutoring going?" asked his master.
"Fine, master.
I now know more about the ducal houses than I ever wanted to know. Bunch of inbred buggers, aren't they? Look, I've got a problem. I need your help."
"How may I be of service, master?"
Tyndall asked, using his best court manners. Sarkay had required them to use such formal address as much as possible.
"Impressive.
Thank you, master,"
Tyndall said, pleased.
"Not you. Sarkay. I didn't think he could teach you and Rondell manners. The Westwoodmen brought a report to me today. It seems one of their hunters was ranging southwest of Sevendor and came across something troubling. Someone in the next domain over seems to be secretly mining snowstone."
"Snowstone? Are you certain?"
"No, which is why I am speaking to you. Whatever I did to create it in the first place wasn't concerned with my property rights. From what I can tell, there are outcroppings of snowstone in at least two other domains. The larger of the two is this one, Tarragwen. The Lord of Tarragwen is a vassal of the Lord of Sashtalia, so he's not going to be pleasantly disposed to an embassy from Sevendor, not after what we did to his ally, the Warbird. But he might not take too much notice of a small hunting party or such. The estate is supposed to be great hawking and fox-hunting territory."
"I don't know how to hunt, master,"
Tyndall confessed. "I'm sure you'll get around to it, but you don't need to hunt. I want you and Sire Kay and Rondell to take a gentleman's stroll down there and see what is actually happening. The last thing we need is for the dead god to get his non-existent hands on it. You're more than a day closer than I am, and I think between the three of you I can get a good report. I shall inform Sire Kay of your orders, master. Is there any other service I might do for you? How are things between you and Ron?" he asked quietly.
"We're civil, master,"
Tyndall replied cautiously. "No more incidents." "See that there aren't," he ordered. "I've got enough going on without the two of you clawing at each other's eyes like a couple of five-year-old girls. The war is heating up in Gilmora again. A lot of raids, and always where we expect them least. No dragons yet, but it's early in the season. We might be making another quick trip back there if things don't quiet down."
"Yes, master."
Tyndall didn't feel comfortable revealing to Master Minolin the issue at the root of the animosity, his botched handling of the Inarian affair. He was just going to have to be on his guard with his fellow apprentice and hope the usually mild-mannered boy did not snap. There was something dangerous in his eyes now, something Tyndall was wary of. Tyndall outlined the orders to Sire Kay and Rondell over dinner that evening. Carguenian Manor was much smaller than the great hall at Sevendor Castle, much more intimate, but with the Hive sister and her two apprentices dining along with Lady Estrit and her daughter, the two old servants who brought their meal had to dodge and weave quite a bit around the trestle.
"Tarragwen, eh?"
Sire Kay said, stroking his chin as he glanced over at a map on the wall, in place of a tapestry. The map was at least a generation out of date, Tyndall could see, but the essential features hadn't changed.
"Part of Sashtalia's domain now. A marginal estate, if I recall, though better off than Sevendor. But it does extend into the Owari's a ways behind the ridge.
And we can just walk right in, introduce ourselves as fellow nobles, ask to take a look around, and maybe get invited to lunch."
"Nearly," conceded Sire Kay. "Only we'll ride. We are gentlemen of some means. Arriving on foot would belie that."
"But will they just let us wander in?" Rondell repeated skeptically. Peasants who did that sort of thing often got a beating for their trouble, or worse.
"The rules of hospitality demand it," agreed Sire Kay. "To refuse such a reasonable request to a fellow knight without cause would cause talk amongst the Lord's peers."
"For just any wandering knight who happens by?" Tyndall asked in disbelief.
"If he is of gentle birth and begs the boon," Sire Kay said, cutting a rind of cheese to lay between he and Estrit on their common trencher, "then it would be a failure of hospitality to refuse it, and call the Lord's honour into question. A knight could request to spend a full day there, perhaps several, without note.
Free of charge.
It would be inhospitable to charge for a mere knight's board, longer than a night, and the guest may be asked to assist in some minor chore as a service, which he likewise could not refuse, after accepting hospitality.
So a knight could theoretically just go skipping from castle to castle, getting free meals and a fire,
Tyndall began, and drink for free and stable his horse, just because he's a knight, Rondal said, shaking his head in disbelief.
Exactly,
Sire Kay said, satisfied. Further, asking leave to hunt or fish is a common practice, and the lord is almost obligated, save under special circumstances.
I think I just understood a lot more about knights,
Rondal said, his eyes wide. Tyndall knew what he meant. Such rights were sold to the commoners for dear coin. To have them granted to a fellow knight as a matter of course was a huge economic boon to the class. It also explained all the spare chivalry he'd seen clogging up some castles.
At least about errantry,
agreed Tyndall.
It's like a free meal under every manor.
Gentlemen, you make it sound so sordid,
Lady Estrid chuckled.
Knights travel for many reasons, and being able to count on the hospitality of their peers allows them to do so without fear of the perils of the public house. Under the codes of chivalric hospitality, a landed knight who turned away a fellow without good cause would himself lose honour by forcing an errant into an inn, or worse. When you have been riding for days, the last thing you want to do is fight with some bandit over your dinner. But couldn't you just keep travelling like that, from manor to manor, forever?
Some do,
Estret admitted. There are always gentlemen of the road who cannot seem to find a lord to serve. If they stay in any region long enough, their reputation spreads. There are ways to take care of such presumptions.
Like what?
Like requiring him to assist in some noble but tedious task, like collecting rents, or evicting a tenant. In a time of war, his sword is put to use, and he must comply, or expect the accommodations to become less gracious. Hospitality demands food and drink and shelter. It does not specify what kind.
I see,
Tyndall said, calculating just how long he thought he could keep up such a pleasant-sounding lifestyle.
Errantry is no feast day, Lady Estrid said, shaking her head. Many a knight has found himself between castles at sundown, and he is more of a target on the road, due to his station alone. Some errants turn to banditry or pillage to survive, if they become unwelcome and will not move on. Others are content to stretch whatever stipend they have as a legacy until they can secure a position.
So is this mission considered errantry? Asked Rondal.
Yes, agreed Sire Kay.
We are specifically on an errand for our lord, but we are also on an errand to further the noble pursuit of hunting. It would not be uncommon for three good friends to take to the road with a few bottles and scout good hunting grounds, particularly if they had harridans for wives. He smiled good-naturedly at his bride, something I have no experience with, I'm afraid.
So, a knight doing anything that is not actually riding to battle or managing an estate? Any knight on the road is an errant,
essentially, agreed Sire Kay.
It sounds like a recipe for trouble,
Rondal said, his brows knit. Tyndall smiled.
I was thinking the very same thing.
The three set out the next day, with food for a few days prepared by the staff. Lady Estrid bade them a formal farewell, to help the boys practice. Her belly was starting to show, and Sire Kay seemed genuinely loath to leave her, but she assured him that she was safe and in good hands. It would be a few months yet before the baby was due. He deserved a few days relaxing on the road, she insisted. Reluctantly, and only because their master bid him so, did Sire Kay take his leave. The three rode south, stopping that afternoon at Fullanor Manor. The lord, a tenant knight in his 20s called Sir Merendal, was a friend of Sire Kay's, and a cousin of Lady Estrid. He leapt at the chance to avoid the laboursome chore of overseeing the summer hayfields. Leaving the matter in the hands of the manor reeve, he wasted no time in packing a bag and having his horse saddled. He brought along a brace of brown hunting dogs as well. Sir Merendal proved a boon as a travelling companion. He was Master Minolan's age, or thereabouts, a good country knight of noble lineage but modest station. He had welcomed Sire Kay warmly when he learned that his cousin had wed the Alshari knight, and the two had become friends and good neighbours, as Sayake had consulted him about the running of the estate. Tyndall found Merendal a welcome companion, largely because of the large sack of wine he brought. Tyndall was quite fond of wine, and counted it as one of the better benefits of the life of a noble. They toasted each other's health for miles, before they settled into a good travelling pace. Sir Merendal was full of news of the region, and was happy to share it with the boys. He oversaw Fullanor Manor as a vassal of the Baron's son, paying for the privilege of running the lucrative estate. He had yet to take a wife, and seemed in no hurry to, although he discussed his prospects at length. That evening they came to the frontiers of Sandaria, the domain of Birchroot. Just as twilight was settling in, Rondal grinned widely and rode ahead, stopping at a small building just shy of the river. A woman outside greeted him warmly, and from the shape of her belly, she was just a few months ahead of Lady Estrid.
"Dear is she?" he swore, without mentioning the goddess of love's breasts, for once, in deference to Sayake. "Did Sir Rondal go and put a foal in some maid's stable when we weren't looking? It appears there are indeed things about him we don't know,"
agreed Sayake, as he watched the young knight greet the woman. "He does seem quite familiar with her."
"She's comely enough," agreed Sir Merendal.
"But where in seven hells did that bridge come from? It's been 2 years since I've been this way, but I could have sworn—"
"Ah, that explains the riddle," Sayake said, snapping his fingers.
Sir Rondal was tasked with building a bridge in Birchroot as part of a bargain of Mage Lord Minolan's with the Baron last year.
"This must be the famous bridge."
"Famous?" asked Merendal. "How famous? I didn't even know it was here."
"Famous because the mage knight enchanted it," explained Sayake.
"Note the pure white snowstone used in its construction, imported from Sevendor. He ran into some trouble while building it, from what I understand, so he used magic to repair the problem. Now it is said that when regarded from Sashtalia, all one sees is a menacing-looking fortress. From here, a pleasant little inn." The Birchroot Inn was pleasant, though crude and under construction. Apparently Rondal did know the proprietor and his family, and made a point of introducing them like old friends. Even more impressive, the innkeeper, Baston, insisted on treating them all to bed and board that night at his own expense, saying that Rondal's coin would never spend there. Baston was a stout fellow, a former highwayman, from what he said, although Tyndall doubted it. The man was far too congenial to be a bandit, but he knew his way around a crock of ale. It was odd, though, seeing Rondal as the object of gratitude and respect of others like that. Not that he wasn't worthy of it, Tyndall reasoned as he grew sleepy by the fire, but he had rarely seen his fellow apprentice so animated and social. After the cool demeanour of the last few weeks, it was a startling change.
"At least you know it was not he who tucked the innkeeper's wife," Sir Merendal murmured, watching the three of them talk around a table. "She only has eyes for her husband. A rogue, perhaps, but an entertaining one."
"He brews well enough, too," admitted Tyndall, draining his glass. "And the stew was good."
He couldn't bring himself to voice suspicions of the friendly man, but anyone who treated Rondal that respectfully had to be up to something. He fell asleep near the fire, considering just what the innkeeper was plotting with his fellow apprentice. The next morning he woke unmolested, unravaged and unrobbed, to the smell of biscuits and hot tea. They left with fond well wishes and blown kisses. Tyndall did have to admit, when they'd crossed the bridge and he'd looked back at it, that the enchantment his fellow had crafted was impressive, and grudgingly told Rondal so. He thanked Tyndall graciously, which made it all the more irritating. They approached their goal before he realized it. Tarragwyn was a sliver of an estate that stood on the other side of the southwestern ridge of Sevendor. Part of the Lord of Sashtalia's domain, Tarragwyn, like Sevendor, had been passed from one henchman to another over the years. Unlike Sevendor, it had not suffered neglect. It was just remote, small, and had little arable land. It was not a particularly healthy estate, with only 200-odd acres under cultivation, mostly rye and barley with some wheat. It grew enough to support the village of Tarragwyn and the small fortress there, but little more. Sir Merendal informed them of its scant history as they rode toward the squat tower and keep on the hillside. Once part of the great Lensley landholding empire, Tarragwyn had been carved off of larger domains,
mostly to reward loyal retainers with some sort of estate for their upkeep. The castle was little more than a modest three-story shell keep and four-story round tower, with a thick wooden palisade surrounding. On parchment, Sir Merendal told them, the estate had 20 hearths and owed service for 4 lances. In actuality, there were 300 or 400 souls within its bounds, most of them living in near poverty. But the village boasted a soap maker and a small trade in apothecarial herbs. I recall visiting a few years back, Baron Arathaniel's vassal told them. I was on duty at Chepston at the time. The Baron wanted to buy hardwoods, and Tarragon has more wood than field. The village is no prize, not even a proper manor, as it is proximate to the castle. Just a common hall for moots and such. No inn, no mill, no proper smithy. But the countryside is wild and fair. I stayed 3 days and went hunting one of them with Sir Corvian, the castellan at the time, a most hospitable fellow. So who rules Tarragon now? Tyndall asked, curious. From what I understand, Sir Corvian was transferred to a richer estate by Sashtalia. The present castellan is Sir Pangine, a local man, long a trusted man-at-arms of the Lord of Sashtalia, and rewarded with the estate when he remarried. His wife died a few months after he took office, but that doesn't seem to have affected him much from what tales the road tells. He has a circle of fellow knights and men-at-arms he relies on. Let us go see this Sir Pangine, Sire Kay said evenly, and discover to whom he is selling the snowstone. The village of Tarragon was a small affair, a circle of round huts clustered around a single longhouse. There were 4 stone granaries behind it, but little else of note in the unwalled, undiked hamlet. The peasants were well into the spring ploughing, and Tyndall could see 3 teams of ploughmen trudging across the poor soil, their teams of horses and oxen struggling in the mud. They did not look as wretched as the 7 Dori had once been, but they were by no means affluent. They rode to the gatehouse, where a single, bored-looking guard in an iron cap asked their names and business before sending a boy up to the keep for instruction. He came back soon enough, following a middle-aged man well-dressed.
"Hail," Sire Kay said with a slight bow. "I am Sire Kay of Car Gwenyon, and these are my friends, Sir Tyndall, Sir Merendal, and Sir Rondal. Are you the lord of this estate?"
"I have that honour," the knight said, bowing in turn. "I am Sir Pangine, and I hold this estate in the name of the Lord of Sashtalia." "To what do I owe the honour of your visit?" he asked politely, but a bit nervously.
"We merely seek permission to range through your woodlands," Sire Kay said serenely. "We have been told that the hawking and hunting in Tarragon are superior, and we have tired of the grounds around our own domain. Yet I would be loath to make such a journey without the leave of the lawful lord."
It was a reasonable enough request. Sire Kay had explained the subterfuge, pointing out that it was not exactly a lie. A knight valued truthfulness and honesty, he had taught them. That didn't mean he had to be so forthcoming he inadvertently betrayed his master. The knight considered.
"Car Gwenyon, that's north in Lensley territory, is it not?"
"It is," conceded Sire Kay. "I am but new to the region and recently introduced to the lands. As you can tell from my accent, I am a wilderlord, and miss the mighty Mindons. I thought to visit the Uwaris to ease my longing, and I am passionate about the hunt. Tell me, are there moose in these mountains?"
"Moose? Aye, as big as bulls," bragged the knight. "I take 3 or 4 every autumn myself. Yet it is not an appropriate season for such game," he said, curious.
"For my part," Sir Rondal said lazily, "I seek better hawking grounds. I can barely get my bird to take wing before we've reached the limits of the wood and field."
"Tarragon has long held a reputation for good hawking," conceded Sir Pangine.
"And I seek to find a different view after a long winter," Sir Merendal said. "Could we beg permission to scout the fields for the day? I promise we brought enough wine to keep us entertained," he said, patting the wineskin on his saddle. Sir Pangine eyed the sack thoughtfully.
"I see no trouble with that, my lords. Could I persuade you to come warm yourself by the fire inside? It is but a humble keep, but the fire is hot, and I have maps you may find helpful."
The keep was indeed humble, and the 4 travellers were invited to take a seat at the lone permanent table in front of the fireplace. As Sir Pangine summoned glasses and food from his castellan, Sayake took the lead in fleshing out their story. Four knights, comrades, ready to escape the busy ploughing season under the pretext of an errand about hunting. Sayake mentioned his new bride, and then mentioned broadly how, as much as he was enjoying the comforts of marriage, he had found the need to see less of her face for a while. Sir Panjin, twice a widower, nodded understandingly. Little was learned in the great hall from Panjin himself. The man was a glorified caretaker, an older knight, being rewarded for stalwart service with running a marginal estate. But there were few other warriors about, Tyndall noted. He counted one common guard on lookout in the tower, another at the gate. That was it. Not that Taragwen was likely to be attacked, but Tyndall found himself finding fault with its state as a fortress, and imagined how he would conquer the place if he had a mind. When the gentleman departed an hour later, Sayake warmly thanked Sire Panjin and quietly passed him a few coins, in earnest of our desire to hunt these lands, later in the season. As noble and ostensibly gracious a knight as Panjin was, he was also of common enough means to appreciate such largesse. "He will look forward to the next time he sees us," Sayake explained as they rode back down the road toward the village. "It cost us but a few silver and a glass or two of wine, and we have learned a great deal for the price."
"We did?"
Tyndall asked, curious. "I thought he was an old boor, who is careless with how he speaks," Sayake reminded him. "If one knows which questions to ask and how, and if one pays attention to the answer and how it is delivered, then a man might say a few words in passing that give you what you desire to know." "So what did we learn?" Sir Merendal asked, chuckling. "Sir Rondel, how many armed men in the keep?"
"Three, Sayake," the apprentice answered. "Top of the tower, at the gate, and one inspecting the back wall."
Tyndall swore to himself. He'd missed that last one. "Sir Tyndall, what is the most defensible place in the castle?"
"The tower," he answered. "One entrance in with a portcullis and door."
"We also learned that Sir Panjin is the only knight, that his closest neighbour is 6 miles north, that he and his neighbour are not amicable, and that he has not laid eyes on his liege in 2 years.
"Why is that important?" Tyndall asked.
"A man is loyal to his liege in proportion to his proximity and his acquaintance. Sir Panjin served honourably as a mercenary for the Lord of Sashtalia's castellan, and was taken on as caretaker, not liegeman, of Taragwen. While he collects the rents and pays tribute to Sashtalia, Taragwen is not, strictly speaking, his own."
"Why is that important?" Rondel asked. "He looks pretty comfortable to me."
"It is important because a man who watches another man's property fights differently than one who defends his own," agreed Sir Merendal.
"Exactly," agreed Sayake.
"Taragwen is not well defended. It is not in great repair, and it is poorly provisioned. 10 men, at most, could garrison it at once, and there are half that number there."
"So it's a dump," conceded Tyndall. "So what?"
"Did you see any sign of riches, of new wealth?" inquired the knight.
"No,"
Rondel answered. "So, if someone is mining snowstone, Sir Panjin hasn't been involved. He wouldn't let that kind of revenue go without claiming a share."
"Correct," agreed Sayake. "So let us discover who has."
Rondel was able to lead them to the outcropping, using a spell that pointed the direction toward the lowest etheric density in the area. The trail led into a wood and up into the higher reaches of the mountainside. From here, they could see the white peaks of the mountains that had been affected by the spell, but the ridge closest at hand was grey and brown. They had climbed 300 feet up the trail before they discovered the mine. The perimeter of the snowstone spell cut through the southernmost edge of the mountain, and a large expanse of stone had been transformed, as had a shallow valley of soil, home to a small grove of cedars and hickories and ash trees. The mine itself was on the edge of the hollow. An area 3 rods wide had been excavated, the soil removed and the dead vegetation laid aside. A pile of rocks had also been gathered.
"Lewin damn them," Rondel swore. "They've probably taken half a ton of it already."
"Why is this white stone so important?" asked Sir Merendal.
"It is unique,"
answered Tyndall, "and highly treasured among the Magi. Our master, the spellmonger, created it. It makes magic easier to do. Unfortunately, it also makes magic easier to do for goblins, or unscrupulous magi."
The soil also has some interesting properties, Rondel agreed. We're growing a couple of enchanted forests in Sevendor with it, but Master Minolin is worried that it could be misappropriated.
Having a bit of snowstone outside of his control is vexing him, agreed Sayake.
Is there any sign of a camp? Tyndall asked, as he discovered a cache concealed behind some brush.
I think so. Tarpaulin, a bit of food, some firewood and a lantern.
There's a fire pit over here, Sir Merendal called. Looks to be at least 3 or 4 days old.
How did they get it down? Asked Tyndall, looking around. The trail is too narrow for a wain.
They carried it down in sacks, explained Rondel. You can see the impressions in the dirt over here.
This is troubling, murmured Sayake. If you wouldn't mind reporting to your master, Sir Rondel, I want to take a more thorough look around.
They spent nearly an hour searching the outcropping, but found little else to indicate just who had been working the mine, despite their magical inquiries. Rondel spoke with Master Minolin mind to mind, and received instructions about how to proceed.
Hey, Tyndall, he said, after he broke contact and opened his eyes. How much blue magic do you know?
Everything I read, he admitted.
Why?
Because Master Min wants us to do what I did with the birch root bridge, only he wants it a little more subtle. He outlined the nature of the spell. Since putting harmful spells on someone else's lands would be an act of war, Master Min thinks we can figure out who is doing this that way. He wants to know that as much as he wants the mining stopped.
Tyndall agreed to help, and the two boys proceeded to tap into their witchstones and erect a sophisticated spell that would not merely indicate who was doing the mining, but that would act upon their minds without them realizing it. Tyndall was impressed with the plan. He would have just lain in wait for the miner to return.
Sayake insisted on stopping at the cottage closest to the mine and politely questioning the fawning widow who lived there, learning that some men had been going up the mountain and bringing back sacks after he'd paid her a copper. They had claimed that it was merely clay for sweetening the soil, but they were led by an armored man with a long, tattered cloak, the hood of which was always pulled low over his face. Sayake noted that with interest, and then paid the old woman a few more pennies for her time. They made a point of stopping back by Taragwin Castle to thank Sir Panjin, who welcomed them to return at any time, before they struck back for the road north. They discussed the implications of the mine for the greater war along the way, and the challenge of it existing outside of the spellmonger's control.
That will be a problem, agreed Sayake.
It is no secret that my liege, Baron Arathaniel, has aspirations of retaking the former Lensley lands. He has made a proud start after the conquest of last summer, and now the Lord of Sashtalia has lost his most powerful ally in the region. Had we been tarrying in a more important domain, mayhap we would have called too much attention to ourselves, being from Sendaria. But you can wager that the Lord of Sashtalia and his men will be increasingly on their guard against any scouting of their fortifications.
This mysterious hooded figure is intriguing, Sir Merendal said engagingly.
If that is not some sort of spy.
Aye.
But from whom? Asked Rondel. The censorate? Someone from the royal court? The Brotherhood of the Rat? Or just some enterprising hedge mage who realized what a find he had?
We'll know more after the next time they arrive to mine, Tyndall said with a smirk. They pushed on and made the birch root bridge by dusk, just in time to enjoy a dinner of pork and pie. The inn was a little busier that night than before, as a few pack traders had stopped for the night, but it was still roomy. After dinner and the production of a flask of local spirits, the former highwayman-turned-innkeeper, Baston, broke out a battered lute and favoured the half-dozen patrons with a song. Then Sir Merendal led them in a bawdy song after that, which got everyone feeling festive. After that, Sire Kay, to Tyndall's surprise, sang a lovely melody about love in the springtime that did not challenge the limited range of his deep voice. But it was well sung, and totally at odds with the man's appearance as a warrior. Tyndall was almost speechless. He had never considered the older knight a musician, but he did a passable job.
Now you, Sir Rondel, the castellan prompted, gesturing at his fellow apprentice.
Me?
The boy asked, horrified at the prospect. Tyndall couldn't help feel a thrill of pleasure at Rondel's embarrassment. It served him right for being such an introvert.
You must remember that being a knight also carries a social obligation, Sayake prompted.
You are expected to ever be a good companion and cheerful company to liege, comrade, and vassal. At any time you may be asked by your superiors to provide entertainment. The ancient order of professional knighthood, the Narasi Red Branch, would allow no initiate entrance unless he could prove a wholesome companion and also that he was an educated man, Sir Merendal added, pouring more of the strong ale into Rondol's glass to prime him for the trial. Of course, back then the knights were all illiterate, so the only way to prove their knowledge was to recite poems thousands of lines long without a single mistake. Consider yourself blessed by the gods to be born in a more enlightened time. You should always have at least one or two good songs and stories and poems you know you can recite, Sire Kay lectured, and do so entertainingly. Now, in an empty inn among good friends is an excellent time to practice, he said, taking some obvious pleasure in Rondol's discomfort as he tried to squirm his way out of the command. Sire Kay, I think it would be best if you began with something light and humorous, owing to the occasion, Sir Merendal suggested, laughing. Leave the sad ballads for another time. Rondol looked like he had accidentally drank vinegar, but there was no escaping the ordeal, he finally realized. He sighed heavily and struggled to his feet. That's the spirit, lad, Baston, the innkeeper, said, grinning enthusiastically. His wife seemed just as encouraging. What shall you sing? A dirge by the look of him, called one of the patrons, a pack trader getting deep in his cups. How about Roosevelt? He asked hesitantly. Aye, I know that one, Baston agreed, picking the popular tune out on his lute, repeating the chorus, and then nodding to the young knight to begin at his leisure. Rondol opened his mouth, a look of terror on his face, and he began to sing. Tyndall held his breath in anticipation, half expecting his rival to bellow like a donkey. But when he began singing about the maiden Roosevelt and her lover, lost in battle, after a hesitant start, Tyndall was surprised to hear a strong, clear voice that sang with a certain passion, if not confidence. Once again, Rondol had surpassed Tyndall's expectations. For some reason, that soured Tyndall's disposition. It was bad enough that they were sitting near to one of the classier pieces of enchantment Tyndall had ever seen. That bridge was impressive, especially as it was done long before Rondol went to Inarion and learned to do such things properly. But to have him be put on the spot like that and do really well, despite his fear of public attention, that was nearly insufferable. To make matters worse, there were approving nods and smiles from the strangers in the crowd, strangers who didn't know how irritating Rondol could be. Well done, lad, Baston boomed enthusiastically as the crowd applauded. I didn't know you had a voice. It's only recently settled, Rondol admitted sheepishly. I'm glad I remembered the words. I nearly considered singing a marching cadence. Perhaps not the best choice for this venue, Sire Kay nodded. You picked wisely, short, sweet, and well-delivered. Your turn, Sir Tyndall, he added casually. Tyndall stared at the knight, his mouth agape. He had been so focused on Rondol's potential failure that he had forgotten that he too might be expected to perform for the hall. He scrambled desperately for something, anything, but for the life of him he couldn't remember any song he knew well, or completely. Well, what shall I play, young master? The innkeeper asked, smiling. He searched his mind for inspiration, and with Brigger's blessing it came. Just an accompaniment, he directed, for a poem. It was Rondol's turn to look startled. Tyndall knew he had a passable voice, and it seemed to be growing deeper by the day. But he couldn't think of a single song that would not embarrass him for not knowing it all the way through. Poetry, on the other hand, need not be sung, and he happened to have a bit on store. First, a little lighting, he said, stepping into the role of a performer. Unlike Rondol, he not only was not fearful of a crowd, he enjoyed the attention. He cast a pale mage light overhead, bathing him in an unearthly glow. He could see Rondol squirm at the showmanship. I wish to recite to you tonight the Lay of Gessa and Lucando, he said, referencing an old Rimeran ballad of unrequited love. It was in a complicated verse form and had some intricate wording. It was not an easy thing to do from memory, even if one had studied it. Tyndall had not studied it, but he had read it, finding an old copy in the Manciple's library at Inarion.
He had taken a break from his studies and read the old scroll in the hopes that it had some dirty parts. While he had been disappointed that the lyrics were, alas, wholesome and virtuous, he had also had the foresight to employ the memory spells he knew to bring the scroll instantly to his recall. "I tell to you a tale of love and loss," he began, "of hearts and lives torn asunder. For in the wake of war and strife, a lady's heart oft lies ripe for plunder." He continued to recite, reading from the conjured page and speaking slowly and deliberately, while Baston plinked out a complimentary melody in the background. He told the tale of Lucando, the Remeran mercenary, who conquered a rebellious castle on the coast for his liege, and was ordered to put all to the sword, and how Lady Gessa's feminine charms and persuasion kept his wrath at bay until the old duke died, but how, when the new duke came to power, she changed her tune and rejected Lucando. The mercenary then put the castle to the sack in revenge, finally taking his own life in the light of the flames that consumed it in his despair at her betrayal of his heart. It was a sad and poignant tale, and the complex rhythms in the words made it all the more difficult to deliver without becoming confused. But he had it right there in front of him. He was reading it right from the page. He made no mistakes. When he finished with a lowered voice and faded his mage light from existence, the crowd was enrapt and exploded in shouts and applause. "Well done, Sir Tyndall," Baston boomed. "Give me a week and I can make a jongleur of you."
"That wasn't bad," Rondell admitted to him, mind to mind.
"Thanks," Tyndall said grudgingly.
"You too. I had no idea you could sing like that."
"I'm just figuring it out.
But how did you—" "Oh, the memory spell. Why did you bother to enchant that one?"
"Honestly, because it's a skirt flipper. If you can recite that to a girl on a moonlit night, you'll be up her skirts in a flash."
Rondell didn't respond, but he could nearly feel his fellow apprentice blush. That made Tyndall feel better, for some reason.